This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Let both sides explore what problems unite us instead of belaboring those problems which divide us.
History comes full circle this week. It's the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's inaugural address. His brother-in-law, Sergeant Shriver, passed away. And while JFK's brother, Robert, made it his mission as Attorney General to go after the mafia in the 1960s, the mob seems alive and well in New England as this week the feds arrest more than 100 in a sweeping roundup.
They got Whiny, Tony Bagels, they got Jack the Whack, Little John. The FBI picked up Uncle Danny, Marbles, Skinny, Johnny Pizza. If you had a meeting scheduled today with Junior Lollipops, Jimmy Gooch, or Baby Fat Larry, hate to break it to you, but they're probably speaking with their lawyers.
Also seeing their lawyers, Massachusetts inmates who thought they'd won parole, as Governor Deval Patrick suspends release of all parolees. Quite a week to review. And here to go over it with us is Peter Canellos. He's editorial page editor at the Boston Globe. Hi there, Peter.
Hi, Meghna.
And also with us here in the studio, Renee Loth, columnist for The Globe as well. Good to see you again, Renee.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So let's start with this announcement of the suspension of parole for inmates who thought they'd won it. Governor Deval Patrick recently, as we know, overhauled the parole board. Five members of the board were let go in the wake of the killing of Woburn police officer John McGuire by a career criminal who had been paroled. So the suspension of parolees seems like the next step. I don't know whether or not logical, but Renee Loth, your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, it's always a delicate balance to respond to these kinds of crises, institutional crises, a balance between a sort of renewed get-tough approach and kind of overreaction. And I'm a little concerned that the state is now tending toward the latter. I mean, there are thousands of people who are paroled every year in Massachusetts, and you just cannot close the back door because there's just not enough, you know, room in the system. And, you know, of course there needs to be new blood, new ideas, new approaches, and a careful evaluation of each case. But to just shut the door, I just think, even temporarily, I think is going a little too far.
Peter?
Yeah, I basically agree with Renee's point. I think that, you know, making the overall changes on the parole board was justified because you were sort of asserting accountability for this one lapse. But, you know, beyond sort of making a few checks to make sure there aren't other similar lapses going through, this runs the risk of you know, really gumming up the system and also potentially closing off parole for people who've really earned it.
I also wondered about the legality of it. I mean, Leslie Walker, executive director of Prisoners Legal Services, said that, you know, if these parolees or would-be parolees don't get a chance to be released, that they may consider suing the state. Peter, does that make sense to you, the legal prospect?
I suspect that the parole statutes are written in such a way that no prisoner has a right to parole. But, you know, if they could show that the state didn't follow its own procedures or there was no logical basis for this decision, it's possible that they could have a claim.
Yeah, I think, you know, as I understand it, these are people who have already gone through the parole system and have been granted parole. And they're just being frozen, you know, while the state figures out, you know, what to do next. And it's just bad timing. And it seems to me that that's, you know, your rights as a, you know, even as a prisoner, shouldn't be subject to timing.
Mm. Although John Grossman, State Undersecretary of Public Safety, released a statement last night saying that as a result of the transition period to the new leadership at the parole board and to ensure public safety, actions relative to the release of parolees were halted last Friday. So that's the administration's point of view there. Let's move on briefly to some other news today that Governor Deval Patrick also made about cuts in local aid. He proposes a 7% reduction in non-school aid to cities and towns. That's a $65 million cut. Renee, it seems like actually a pretty significant one.
Yeah, well, the governor is trying to pressure the cities and towns to do more reforms on their end to try to save money in their budgets. You know, he wants them to put more of the city municipal employees into the group insurance commission and make changes to the pension benefits and look for ways to save money there. And in a sense, you know, proposing a cut on the front end, he's hoping will push them into making some of these changes. you know, the Massachusetts Municipal Association, where he made this announcement today, they say that, yes, there are some cities and towns that can save a lot of money with these changes. There are others, depending on the plan design they already have for their health insurance for their employees, won't be saving any money. So, you know, their point has always been that the governor is overstating the savings.
Peter, you know, the governor said that while there would be a $65 million cut, the claim is that by moving municipal employees into the group insurance commission, that cities and towns would save some $120 million. And as Renee said, the Municipal Association kind of disputes those numbers. But the question I have is, it seems to me that for quite a while, Governor Patrick has wanted to move employees into the GIC. Is this sort of his way of strong-arming that action into happening?
Well, actually, his plan for moving people into the GIC was not very effective because he ended up giving effective veto power to some of the local unions. I think there needs to be tougher action at the state level to get these changes made. I mean, we're not talking about denying people health care or anything close to it. This is, the GIC is a really good plan, and if municipal governments can save money by moving people into a state plan that really exceeds most of the private plans that are out there, they've got to do it. And, you know, to the extent this is getting a little bit tougher and he may be trying to strong-arm them a little bit, more power to him.
Although I do anticipate that it's probably not going to happen without a fight, though.
It's not going to happen without a fight, but I think in the state, you know, for too often people talk about local aid as this sort of sacred cause, and statewide politicians are always running on the cause of preserving local aid. And there are plenty of inefficiencies in municipal government, you know, starting with the structure itself of 351 cities and towns. We don't do enough regionalization. There's a lot of money to be saved in local government. And you know, until there are cuts in local aid, and we certainly have seen a lot in the last 2 years, there's less incentive for cities and towns to make economies that I think would seem pretty obvious if you looked at them dispassionately.
Yeah, it's important to remember that the entire state is facing a very severe financial shortfall. Excuse me, up to $2 billion. And we're not going to be getting the federal stimulus money that helped bail us out in previous years, last year. You know, and so this is the first salvo in, I think, what's going to be a very difficult budget year. Everybody's going to have to find savings, tighten their belts. I think there's probably going to be some sort of balanced solution that's going to have to be proposed, a little bit more money out of the rainy day fund and cuts and maybe even some sort of revenue enhancements. It's going to be a really difficult year.
Well, moving on to other big stories. This one's a massive regional one. That sweeping mob arrest of 127 men, including 83-year-old Luigi Menacchio, former boss of New England's Patriarca crime family. Peter Canellas, I didn't even know these guys still existed, let alone warranted so much effort from the FBI.
Well, they do exist, and there's a tendency, because of all the popular culture presentations of the mob, to sort of cutify them and to make it a kind of a beloved kind of anachronism and stuff. And hopefully it is becoming a little more of an anachronism, and all the nicknames are really funny and stuff like that. But I suspect for the people who were living in the communities where they were being shaken down every day by the mob, and there were murders that were mentioned in this slate of indictments, it's probably a little less funny. So it sounds to me like it's an effective and appropriate law enforcement action.
And Renee, I mean, Boston's obviously had its own history with the mob and the mafia. Is this still a big deal here? I mean, in terms of these arrests as well?
Yes, I think this is not insignificant. You know, and we do tend to romanticize the mafia, and we shouldn't do that. But we also, you know, shouldn't lose sight of the fact that there are a whole new generation of gangs that have come up in the wake of the mob. Other ethnic gangs, other ethnicities, who are really wreaking havoc in some of these communities with drugs and guns and, you know, violence.
Human trafficking.
And, you know, this is something that I think is maybe this is the last gasp of this generation of Italian mafia. But I think there's still plenty of gang activity out there.
And finally today, we've got a whole slate of Kennedy family-related news. First and foremost, it was... Well, maybe not first and foremost, but first of all, it was President John F. Kennedy's, the 50th anniversary of his inauguration. And of course, he gave the famous, very famous, Ask Not speech at his inaugural. There was another part of it that is one of my particular favorites. And given that he gave the speech at one of the coldest points of the Cold War, there's also a call for civility in the Ask Not speech. So let's hear it.
So let us begin anew, remembering on both sides that civility is not a sign of weakness, and sincerity is always subject to proof. Let us never negotiate out of fear, but let us never fear to negotiate.
Peter Canellos, with all the talk about a return to civility in American political life following the Tucson shootings, those words almost give you a shiver to this day.
Yeah, it's possible he was referring mainly to being civil to the communists and to the Soviets.
Well, but it was a direct reference to that, yes.
It was, but one of the things that I think was very effective in that speech is how he turned the fight against communism into an argument for a fairer society at home, including human rights, civil rights at home. So it sort of works that his call for civility can be read on two levels, as a call for negotiations with communist leaders, but also as a call to sort of dial down the rhetoric at home. And lest people forget, in Kennedy's era, that was also the heyday of the John Birch Society. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of hate-fueled rhetoric, going around during that era as well. So it's a good reminder that the need to maintain civility is a constant priority.
Renee?
Yeah, this speech is just such a classic. I mean, it's like Shakespeare. You listen to it now, 50 years on, and the lines that ring out, ask not, and the torch has been passed, and, all of this, it's just, it does still give you chills. It was a big hit at the time, and it stands up 50 years on.
I also want to play a little tape from Sergeant Shriver, John F. Kennedy's brother-in-law, of course, who passed away this week at the age of 95. Ran the Peace Corps, Job Corps, Special Olympics, a huge figure in American public service. Here's a little tape from him in the 1960s talking about a challenge that an Indian diplomat gave him when he was out stumping for Peace Corps volunteers around the world.
She said, "You think that young Americans possess the spiritual values they must have to bring the spirit of your country to our country? There's a great valuelessness spreading in the world," she said. "Your volunteers must bring us more than science or technology. They must touch the idealism of America and bring that to us."
Sergeant Shriver in the 1960s there. Renee Loth, your thoughts on the passing of this particular part of the Kennedy family?
Well, the Peace Corps is such an enduring legacy of the Kennedy years, and Sergeant Shriver was so important to, the first class of this. I mean, I know so many people who, in my generation who were in the Peace Corps, and my son's generation are in it too. And it's just, it sounds a little corny maybe, but it's just so important to have ambassadors of American, optimism and values around the world. And that need has not diminished.
And of course, there's possibly a chapter in terms of the next generation of Kennedys, with Joe Lieberman saying he's going to step or not run again for Senate in Connecticut. There's a word out there that maybe Ted Kennedy Jr. might consider throwing his hat into the ring for the Senate seat in Connecticut. So we'll see what happens with that. But as we wrap up today's Week in Review segment, as always, our weekly hubbub. Peter Canellos, yours first.
The House of Representatives in Massachusetts has moved to enforce a proper dress code. And I would say there are two observations about that. That means no jeans, no Bruins jerseys, no spaghetti straps. But
no flip-flops.
For one thing,
what will we wear?
What will we wear? Well, I think it is interesting that casual dress has gotten so extreme. In the summer, it's like you can – there's nothing beyond casual left to go to except being naked all the time. But so we're probably due for a little bit of a pullback on the dress set front. But it was also interesting that while the House is busy worrying about its dress code and everything, they managed to defeat a maneuver calling for, or a measure calling for, a direct roll call vote when they raise taxes. So they're minding one side of the store, but not the other.
Renee Loth, yours.
Well, quick, can you name your governor's counselor? I didn't think so.
I've never done well with pop quizzes.
The Governor's Council, which is a kind of a vestigial remnant of the colonial era in Massachusetts, a sometime buffoonish body, has been thrust into the spotlight now with the hearings into the new Supreme Judicial Court nominee and all of the new members of the parole board. So you're going to be seeing a lot of these people. It's an opportunity to redeem their somewhat tattered reputation. Let's see if they can do it.
Okay, well, my hubbub is looks forward to baseball season with the Red Sox. The town of Brookline this week announced that a certain strip of Beacon Street between St. Mary Street and Hawes Street, they're going to actually charge $22 to park at the metered spots there versus, I guess, the couple dollars it used to cost. I still say it's cheaper than the $30 you got to pay to park in a lot, but Red Sox fans are outraged at the thought that Brookline might be trying to cash in on being right next door to Fenway Park. So that's my hubbub for the day. Peter Canello's editorial page editor for the Boston Globe. Always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Magda.
And Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe. Have a wonderful weekend as well.
Thank you. Stay warm.
Coming up in just a minute, we'll hear from a musical prodigy, Brookline native 18-year-old jazz saxophonist with a princess's name, Grace Kelly. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.